Welcome to a special edition of Coffee House Shots for Spectators Daily Podcast. We're getting a new Prime Minister on Tuesday, probably Boris Johnson, elected on a promise to take us out of the European Union on the 31st of October and not a day later. So can you really call this a great betrayal of those who voted for Brexit? Rod Little thinks so. His book, The Great Betrayal, is in bookshops now, and he joins me to discuss. Rod, from the title of your book, you don't sound very optimistic about Boris's chances of honouring his promises.
Well, I wasn't very optimistic when I started writing the book, and I'm even less optimistic now since I've heard a number of things from Boris, most of which say the likes of we must say no, we must hold up a no deal, and we must leave by October the 31st, we can't say we will have no deal. And then in the next breath saying there is a 1 in a million chance of no deal. So the no deal is a paper tiger, exactly as it was when Theresa May was trying to forge a deal with the European Union and was let down by her front benchers. And of course we've also had the MPs voting to ensure that there will be no prorogation of Parliament. So no, I'm not terribly convinced we're going to get any sort of a deal. I think it'll probably be Theresa May's deal with lipstick on the pig, as it's been put to me before now. But the book really is about the failure of the government to see through the mandate that it was given by the British people on the 23rd of June 2016 by the leave date of March the 29th. And more importantly, how the politicians managed to get themselves into that position.
But I have, I've read and edited hundreds of your columns over the years. You didn't write
about... I'm sorry.
No, it's been a pleasure. A bit hair-raising at times, but still. But the thing is, you hardly ever mentioned Europe before the referendum. Even during the campaign, you didn't seem particularly interested in the subject. So why is it after the result that you're so interested in Europe that you're writing a book about Brexit?
Yeah, because I'm not really writing the book about the European Union. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Europe comes a little bit down my agenda. No, it's been there, here and there. And certainly was when I was at the BBC and commissioning stories about how the European Union was indeed planning a constitution, planning a joint army, all the things which at the time Alistair Campbell denied that they were doing at all. But you're absolutely right. It's not the fact that we're not actually leaving the European Union that has angered me so much. It was an incredibly close call for me when it came to the vote. It's the chicanery, the lies, the deception, the demonisation of the Leave vote. It's all the things which have happened to those 17.4 million people who voted Leave since the referendum. It's the British politics of it that has infuriated me far more than the fact that, I don't think we're going to be leaving the European Union in any proper form at all.
Now, you open this book expecting it to be a kind of gung-ho, Rod Little case for Brexit. But in the first few pages, you admit that you were in two minds in the referendum, that you were quite agonised about which way to jump. And in fact, you go through page after page of reasons for voting Remain, reasons that gave you pause before you decided to go with the cause that you're now so enthusiastic about. So can you say a bit more about those reasons that did make you almost back Remain, the reasons that gave you pause?
Yeah, no, real pause, real worry. I mean, obviously, partly I bought into the Project Fear stuff. I think everybody did. And when we talk about the lies put about by the Leave campaign, some of the stuff which was put out by the Remain campaign, which I go through in the book. I mean, on day one of the campaign, Better in Europe put out a leaflet saying, for every £1 Britain gives to Europe, we get £10 back. Mm. Which is, an incredibly misleading statement. But no, there were many, many reasons. I mean, the first of them, I suppose, is that perfectly reasonable idea of a Pacific entity, of an institution which had actually managed to keep Europe peaceable after centuries of discord. I think that does have some force. I think also I'm very interested in investment in science and technology, and I do think, even though it's undemocratic, that funding sometimes needs to be ring-fenced from the five-year parliamentary cycle, where it sometimes gets swallowed up or lost. And I was particularly interested in work going on, for example, on nuclear fusion at the Torus lab in Oxfordshire. You know, so there was that. Then there was also the feeling that my own home area, the northeast of England, which has got quite a bit of money from, not as much as it should, not as much as, for example, Liverpool.
£500 million it's got. That's not exactly small change.
No, it's not small change. It's not a huge amount, but it's not small change. I did worry that there would be the very area I'd want to support the most for communal and family reasons and reasons of affection would be the worst hit by it. I think it's possible. I mean, you look at Liverpool. I mean, Liverpool really has benefited from the European Union without question, and it's maybe one reason why Liverpool voted so heavily to remain, you know, and I can see that. So there are all those reasons, and a few more besides, as to why it was a tough call for me. The Lexit reasons, the reasons for leaving, which I call Lexit, are immigration, which of course is always portrayed as a right-wing reason, but it's not at all. It's, I mean, my objection is to the exploitation of cheap labour, the way it drives down the wages over here, even if not by much, but still, you know, significantly when you're at the low end of the pay spectrum, but also the terrible conditions, the appalling conditions, working conditions that the workers have to survive under, you know, which are documented in the book and have been documented before, largely by the left-wing press rather than the right-wing press. You know,
but let's talk about the examples that you do document in the book. I mean, you mention an example, a report in The Guardian about how one of the reporters went to find some Poles who were working. 20
That's
Poles,
right.
20 Poles were in the house that night, 10 of whom were sleeping there, 3 or 4 to a small room. Your point was that these are miserable, exploitative conditions, the sort of thing that ought to annoy left-wingers. But here's the thing, the article was from 2005, and since then, the conditions of Poles has, I mean, the debate has changed completely. 2005 was just at the very beginning of the wave of EU migration. I mean, now you've got Poles are the second biggest group in Britain, second biggest language group, and it's not as if they're all living 22 a room in sheds. I mean,
I disagree entirely. I mean, without question, Polish immigration, there are some white collar Poles who've come here, and indeed some blue collar Poles who've done here and done okay and are living perfectly well. But there are still appalling conditions for overseas workers who come here, particularly in London. You will see the reports pretty much every week in the Daily Mail, you know, living, you know, 5 or 6 to a room in conditions which wouldn't have been out of place, you know, in the 1830s. And it's still going on. And, you know, take a trip to Boston and see how the fruit pickers and the Brussels sprouts pickers live there. You know, these are very, very low-waged people who, for obvious reasons, are crammed into pretty appalling accommodation. This doesn't detract from the fact that, you know, many of the Poles have done very well for themselves, but an awful lot haven't.
Right, but another argument there. I've got a friend who's a farmer in the Highlands. Now, he wants seasonal workers, lots of farmers do. But one of his complaints is if you want to actually hire Poles, you need to give them a significant chunk of work, and they will ask to basically also have accommodation. They're quite happy to sleep 5 or 10 to a room because they're only going to be there for a short amount of time. They want to come here, work their socks off, go back to Gdansk with as much earnings as they can make. So it's their free will. The farmer wants to employ them. Where is the great social menace in all of that?
Well, there's two things. Firstly, they shouldn't have to live like that. They say that they will or not. And secondly, if they are having to live like that, look at the competition that is raised against the British workers in those particular countries. I mean, I'm sure your Highland farmer in Sutherland or wherever it is was farming 20 years ago, and he must have employed someone. Who did he employ? You know, if you're bringing Poles over who don't have mortgages, who will sleep 10 to a room or 5 to a room or whatever, then clearly they're on a lower rate of pay than they would be if they were having to support themselves.
But I'll tell you what would happen previously. School kids like me, we had what we called the tatty holidays, October holidays. We went out, we helped pick potatoes, we earned.
That's right.
And there is no way kids nowadays are going to be able to do that because we've been basically...
It'd be rather good if they did, though, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, personally, I think so. I love the tatty holidays. It was a complete result. But you will not have kids rooting out potatoes now, because the thing is, as this country has grown richer, there are jobs which people in this country don't want to do. A lot of them involve berry picking and fruit picking. So what's the problem in getting in Polish people to do jobs that... You're not putting British people out of a job there. They simply don't want to be doing these jobs.
I just disagree. I mean, as you know, I would. I mean, it's the one area where we do disagree. I would pay people more, give them a decent standard of living, and perhaps charge a little bit more for the potatoes. You know, that's probably the answer that I would give in the end. I think that's preferable to exploiting unskilled labour. I don't like the idea of the free movement of labour. It's the means, as Mr. Marx put it, by which the rich get richer. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing in itself, but I just think it has a deleterious effect upon the country, upon the workers themselves, and I don't believe they're all absolutely delighted and happy. And I took the piss out of that very suggestion in a film I made for the Sunday Times immediately after Brexit, you know, which was of a Norfolk farmer saying, "I don't pay the Poles anything, they bloody love it, they love me for it." I just don't buy it, mate.
Well, you're certainly right to say that you and I do differ on quite a few things. You also try to look at the party politics of your fellow leavers. And there's a fascinating section in the book here. You say, who do they vote for, these unrepresented people? Well, speaking as one of them, I continue to vote Labour, despite losing the party's infantile far-left agitprop, visceral anti-Semitism and apparent contempt for everything about this country. Okay, not exactly a ringing endorsement of Corbyn, but you do say here, I continued to vote Labour. So did you actually then vote for Jeremy Corbyn?
Fuck no. No. Sorry. No, I last voted Labour and wrote you a column on it in 2015. And if I remember rightly, David Cameron said to you, I explained why I was voting Labour, and David Cameron, if I remember, told you that it was the best advert for the Conservative Party he'd ever read. That's the last time I voted Labour. In the Euro elections this year, I voted Brexit. In the general election 2017, I made the brilliant, valiant decision to travel from, because we've got votes in two addresses, one down here in Canterbury and one up in Middlesbrough South and East Cleveland. And I decided, my wife and I decided, Canterbury's rock solid for the Tories. Let's go up and vote Tory in Saltburn. See what happened there as well. Canterbury went to the Labour Party and the Tories actually did win Saltburn, Middlesbrough South and East Cleveland. So I voted Tory then. I don't think I'd vote Tory again. I don't like them very much, Fraser.
Right. Now, talking about not liking people very much, one of your chapters is called I Don't Know Anyone Who Voted Leave. Now, the phenomenon you look at there is the idea that people who voted Remain had a social group that was almost exclusively Remain, and where it's pretty unusual for anybody not to know anybody voted a different way in a general election, that when it came to Europe, there's been a lot more clustering. Now, of course, you know, I'm sitting here in London, you're sitting at your place in Salford, but Londoners, you'll get clusters of Remain. But isn't the same thing true with Leavers? Aren't there also people wandering around saying, I voted Brexit and I don't know anybody who didn't?
No, I don't think so. Certainly not to the same degree. I think that the demography is very, very interesting. I don't think that there is a meaningful difference at all in the demographic makeup of 2/3 to 3/4 of the Remain vote and, I would say, 9/10 of the Leave vote. It is just that section, that small section, and it could be somewhere between, I don't know exactly how many people it is, somewhere between 3 to 5 million, I would have thought, who voted Remain. And genuinely, when they say, I don't know anyone who voted Leave, mean it. And it's an interesting issue, because Charles Murray's done some work on this in America, and his is basically geographically based in that you're getting these super zips where the hyper-liberal elite live. Mm-hmm. I think you're getting the same thing here. It's less geographical, though, than occupational. So you look at the figures which we've got for some of the occupations. So I think it's 93% of scientists, 96% of academics. I don't know what it is at the BBC. I would have thought 114% voted Remain. The teaching profession, 70% voted Remain, and almost certainly a lot higher than that in the southeast of England. The lovies, the actors, the celebs, again, in the 90s, and there have been studies which prove this. So when those guys are saying, you know, I don't know anyone who voted Leave, they mean it, because within their milieu, really nobody voted Leave. And I think that's been the main problem with the BBC and its coverage since 2016, when, of course, during the referendum, under the Representation of the People's Act, they actually behaved themselves and were fairly unbiased. But since then, it's been a sort of torrent of anti-Brexit propaganda. And, you know,
can I pick you up on that? You've got a chapter here called In Spite of Brexit, where you look at the BBC's coverage.
Yeah.
You say that there's all of this bias, but are you really saying that you can hear anti-Brexit bias in the reporting of the political staff of Nick Robinson, of Laura Kunzberg?
No. It's not quite as simple as that, is it? It's not Nick Robinson, and it's not Laura Kunzberg. I mean, Laura Kunzberg is admirably even-handed. It's some of the presenters, but it's not even that. It's the fact that within that milieu, almost nobody voted Leave. And I know hundreds of people in the BBC, and I know one person who voted Leave, and he won't tell anyone for good reason. And so they actually are shocked when they're accused of this bias, because there is literally no one around who will articulate it for them in the workplace. And you know, you look at Question Time and Any Questions, the Institute for Economic Affairs did a study about representation of Brexiteers and Remainers on that programme, and it was 68%.
But you're assuming, Rod, that they all back Remain. But you know, how would you know?
I'm not assuming they all back Remain. I'm not assuming that. I'm telling you as a fact they back Remain, because as I say, I know hundreds of people there, and none of them, one of them, voted Leave. I mean, it is an ad. I was told by someone that on Newsnight, for example, only one person in the entire staff of what I would guess is somewhere in the region of 60 voted Leave. They simply didn't vote. They don't know anyone who votes Leave. And I'm on Facebook. I'm Facebook friends with literally hundreds of them. None of them voted Leave. I went to a lovely birthday party for an old friend from the BBC. Everyone there was from the BBC, 100 people. I was the only leaver. You know, it is absolutely clear. And it's not unsurprising. It's the same sort of percentage as we find in academia. It's the same sort of percentage as we find amongst the creative arts, you know, the actors and the pop singers. It's exactly the same.
Right, but first off, it shouldn't really matter how they voted. What matters is how they do their journalism. And secondly, we have a pro-Brexit government. Brexit is the agenda. It's the job of journalists to scrutinise the government. So, of course, they're going to be asking difficult questions of Brexit. Of course they're going to be giving the government
a hard
time. They
should ask difficult questions of Brexit, but that's not the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that they are biased against Brexit. They're biased against Brexit when Kamal Ahmed, the Director of Editorial Policy or whatever it's called, sends out a letter to everybody and tells them that Brexit's a bit rubbish. it's that percentage on Question Time and Any Questions, the most important political programmes that they have, and there's been a bias in numbers of 68% to 32%. You know, over 2 years, it's inescapable. And you saw an example of it this week with my interview with Emily Maitlis on Newsnight. You know, there's a real hostility there.
Right, but again, wasn't Emily Maitlis doing what her job is to ask very critical questions of whatever guest she gets? We see her doing that day after day.
She didn't ask them of the Remainer, though, did she? Her most pressing question to the Remainer was, "Go on, Tom," which I think lacks something in terms of rigour. And of course, she was urging him to go on with the very point that she was making. But you know, leaving her aside, it's difficult to. I mean, we've quantified it, and it's also been by the Wilson report, which showed that the BBC was serially biased on Europe. In other words, that it was pro-EU. And the in spite of stuff, of course, comes from those news reports, with countless news reports, which always begin with, in spite of Brexit, investment's up. In spite of Brexit, unemployment's down.
But that isn't the BBC so much now. You see that in the trade press and in local newspapers. You hardly ever see the BBC using the phrase, in spite of Brexit.
No, they've probably stopped it recently, but for a good year and a half after Brexit, it was almost ubiquitous, and it became a standing joke. They even managed to get a Remainer argument into Doctor Fucking Who. I mean, fortunately, most children have turned off Doctor Who because it's so woke, so they won't have been subjected to it. But there were loads of complaints to the BBC about an issue of Doctor Who where there was a clear, you know, Remainer propaganda thread in this programme about Daleks. And, you know, it's the same with the comedy shows, the chat shows. It's massively, massively pro-Remain. I don't believe you don't think it is either.
Well, to be honest, I don't think it's nearly as biased as you think it is. And I'm wondering whether you have also been radicalised in the way that you say the Remainers have been radicalised. Whether it's a situation that if you feel embattled, if you feel that your side is being betrayed on all grounds, that you end up wandering off to a certain kind of hard Brexit edge that you never were at to start. Because you started off basically not knowing which way to vote in this referendum. You've just discussed it. And now you've ended up using the word betrayal, a very strong word, first of all, before Brexit's even been decided, and secondly, presumably, to refer to any form of Brexit, which is not the end of the customs union, the end of the single market. Yeah. I mean, there were lots of forms of Brexit, but you've started from a sort of borderline position to thinking that anything...
Well, hang on a sec. There are two separate things. Firstly, the word betrayal. I'm hardly the first to have used it. I mean, Nigel Farage has used it. Most of the Brexit party use it habitually.
Well,
and Boris Johnson's used it. I do feel it is a betrayal. It's a betrayal of 17.4 million people by largely the political class, but also part of the liberal elite. As for the issue as to what sort of Brexit I want, what sort of Brexit I wanted when June 24th came around was a Brexit which meant that we left the EU properly, i.e. in all its appurtenances, be that the European Courts of Justice, be that Customs Union, and so on. And I do tend to agree with Matthew Paris, who I think this was, which he wrote for The Spectator shortly, or it might have been for The Times, and I think it was after the Chequers deal, that aborted deal, that here we are in a position whereby we're all worse off.
Right.
The Remainers think this is ludicrous, and the Leavers think it's ludicrous. How could that possibly be right? And I think that has some force.
But take the customs union, Rod. I mean, do you passionately feel that the customs union would be some form of enslavement and that would be better off trying to do a free trade deal with the United States? I would have thought somebody on the left, as you still describe yourself as being, would have deep concerns about a kind of capitalist free trade bonanza that ends up with the NHS being sold piecemeal to American healthcare giants.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think that that's going to happen. And if it does, it happens under a government which we elect, which is the important thing. But, you know, also from the left, I'm not happy about the way in which the EU has its own protectionism and keeps out imports from the third world, particularly Africa, particularly North Africa, and particularly the Commonwealth, you know, to which I also feel some sort of rooted bond of historical tradition. I have no problem with us at all striking a decent deal with the Americans, or for that matter, the Ruskies, but that's a different issue, I suppose.
When you tell people that you're left-wing, Rod, do you find a few of them refusing to believe you?
Yeah, of course, but only idiots. I mean... You know, I support quite a few of John McDonnell's tax policies, for example, and nationalisation policies. I mean, the trouble is that there's a certain section of the left, which isn't, to my mind, really the left. It's a kind of left liberalism, which which fetishizes, you know, identity politics, which I'm not at all left-wing on, and conflates immigration, people who are opposed to immigration, with racism and the usual chant of racist. So they can think what they like, you know. I mean, I'm a social democrat, mate, innit?
The last sentence in your book, Brexit at least showed us a picture of a country dominated by a hyper-liberal elite that has power without hegemony.
Yeah.
It strikes me, Rod, that your position on Brexit isn't really about the European Union. It's not really about the customs union or the single market. It's about a whole bunch of people who you don't like very much, who have got really angry about Brexit. And it's about something which is about other things than the European Union and the various things it raises.
I think you're half right. I think you've rather flippantly characterised the objection, but you're certainly right that I think that, you know, if there's a good thing that's come out of what I think has been a betrayal of Brexit, it has been that it's revealed to the public that there is a vast gulf between what a pretty large proportion of the country, probably a majority, want from their leaders on a whole range of issues, and what the liberal elite, which is actually quite small, you know, I'd say it's that 3-4, 3-4-5 million people, always get their way and wish to have their opinions foisted on everybody else. So I think it has done that. And you're right. It's not that I don't like these people. Some of them are very pleasant. It's just that I don't think that their views are shared widely across the country. And I don't think it's right. I don't like their totalitarianism, or, to put it softer, authoritarianism, in making sure that their values are the ones which prevail, which is what I've been writing about for the last 20 years for The Spectator.
And if we do leave the EU without a deal on the 31st of October, will you do a follow-up book saying, sorry, I was wrong, there wasn't a betrayal after all?
Yeah, the book looks a bit shit then, doesn't it?
Well, you better hope it sells before at the end of October.
Well, it's out now, mate. The Great Betrayal. The betrayal was about that 3-year, 2.5-year period, whereby the mandate was given and it should have been respected. And it's about the way in which the Parliament and the various other institutions, including obviously the civil service, were able to sort of subvert that mandate. And it's still being subverted. So if the book does anything, if it's of any use, it will be to make people feel a bit angry and to add impetus to Boris Johnson's attempts to get us a proper deal rather than, as we were talking about, a pig with lipstick on, and to actually leave on October the 31st. I hope that's what happens. I hope very much that's what happens. But I have my doubts.
Well, we'll see. Rod Little, thanks very much for joining me.
Pleasure, mate.